we really decided on doing this review on LSD, MDMA, ayahuasca, and psilocybin because they've been increasingly covered by the media for their therapeutic potential over the past 5 years.
So really, understanding the pharmacology of these compounds may well help us understand the neurobiology of depression, PTSD, as well as some pretty interesting constructs such as mysticism and social connectedness.
That's Dr. Colin Reif and Dr. William McDonald talking about the clinical application of psychedelic drugs in psychiatric disorders. Their work appears in the May 2020 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. I'm Michael Roy, Executive Editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, and this is AJP Audio. Dr. Colin Reif is a clinical assistant professor with the Department of Psychiatry at New York University Langone Health. He specializes in addiction psychiatry. Dr. William McDonald is affiliated with the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University in Atlanta. He is the J.B. Fuqua Chair for Late Life Depression and Director of Geriatric Psychiatry and of the ECT and Neuromodulation Services. Dr. McDonald has concentrated his research efforts on treatments for severe and treatment-resistant depression. Dr. Reif and Dr. McDonald are co-authors of a review article in our May issue with their colleagues from the Workgroup on Biomarkers and Novel Treatments, a division of the American Psychiatric Association Council of Research. The article is titled, Psychedelics and Psychedelic-Assisted Psychotherapy. Dr. Reif, Dr. McDonald, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Now, your review article begins with some history about the use of hallucinogens. Many cultures used hallucinogens derived from plants for many centuries for religious and mystical reasons, but their application to medicinal use did not arrive until the 20th century. So first, could you provide an account of how hallucinogens were first used, and then talk about some of the key players involved in the development of these drugs for medical use?
So hallucinogens have been used around the world, you know, for the past 1,000 years. There's evidence that they were used in Peru and Bolivia. They've been used in sub-Saharan Africa. Some even say that they were used in ancient Greece. So hallucinogens kind of, you know, specifically psilocybin made its way from Mexico to the United States and then ultimately to Paris and then Switzerland through Robert Gordon Wasson and his wife, Valentina Pavlona Guerkin. What happened is they went out to find magic mushrooms in Mexico in 1955. And they had the good fortune of connecting with a Maztecan curandera by the name of Maria Sabina. And Maria Sabina welcomed them into a mushroom ceremony and they had psychedelic experience. What then happened is Gordon Wasson went back with, you know, Roger Heim, and who collected these mushrooms, and Roger Heim identified them as the genus psilocyb, and then gave them to Albert Hofmann at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland. And he, as a chemist, had first isolated psilocin and psilocybin, which are the actual psychoactive compounds within psychedelic mushrooms. And then from there, what happened is they made their way to Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert at Harvard, because Sandoz was advertising psilocybin as well as LSD for psychiatric research at that time. And then, you know, from the Harvard Psychedelics Club, you know, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert kind of took them into the mainstream just through commentary they had made and also by bringing in, you know, students to their lab. Ironically, I mean, it just so happens that Albert Hofmann is the chemist that first synthesized LSD. He did that in Sandoz in 1938 and serendipitously took it in 1943. So I think it's important to highlight because Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, the company that makes Clozaril, is also really responsible for sending psychedelics into psychiatry. And so that's the story. I might also note that Maria Sabina's home was later burned down by her community because they thought that she had kind of gone against the culture, her culture, by welcoming Westerners into their sacred religious practice. It was later revealed that Gordon Wasson's mission to go find Maria Sabina and the magic mushrooms was financed by MKUltra, which was the CIA's psychedelics research project to determine if they could use this for mind control in some way.
Wow, that's fascinating. And you had mentioned Timothy Leary, which I think conjures up the 1960s. And the 1960s brought growing concern in the United States and Europe about the use of these drugs by the general public and for research purposes. What led to this worry, and what actions did U.S. policymakers take at the time?
Well, I'm old enough that in the 60s, I would have been in elementary school, and I can remember going into the local drugstore, and on the counter were spreads of comic books about the dangers of drugs. I remember one was titled LSD Causes Birth Defects. These drugs were such a part of the counterculture, and Richard Nixon in 1970 declared a war on drugs. So added to that, some of the people who were doing research, Colin had talked about Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary is a professor at Harvard, and he was an icon in the 60s, but he did really very little to advance the therapeutic potential for these drugs and did a lot of harm by demonstrating how easily they could be abused. Given the information they had at the time, it seems to me the policymakers at that time did what made sense, which is they began to restrict the use of these drugs. And in 1970, the Controlled Substances Act effectively put a halt to much of that research. And really, we undertook this paper to try and relook at that and see if there really is evidence to continue research in this area.
The last decade has seen renewed interest in psychedelic compounds, especially on their potential therapeutic benefits. How have opinions changed from the 1960s to the present?
Well, I'm not really sure it's the opinions that have changed as much as times passed. People are willing to relook at these drugs to potentially help with treatment-resistant patients. And right now, we need more treatments. In the 60s, the understanding of the depression was very different from today. There was a strong anti-psychiatry movement. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out in 1975. The general public is now more willing to see depression as a medical disorder and not necessarily as a character flaw. Prozac was first marketed in 1987. SSRIs have been revolutionary in the treatment of depression, but there's multiple studies now showing the significant number of people don't respond to antidepressants, including SSRIs. And maybe we really need to look for a different approach. And I think ketamine infusion therapy sort of offered a glance at that. They offered a different approach using a different mechanism of action. And now people want to look at psychedelics as novel treatment for patients. And these patients have few other options.
So let's get to what your review article looked at. You and your colleagues aim to provide an evidence-based summary of the literature on the clinical application of psychedelic drugs in psychiatric disorders. How did you go about conducting this research?
So we searched PubMed and PsycINFO via Ovid for articles in peer-reviewed journals reporting on LSD, MDMA, ayahuasca, and psilocybin in human subjects. And we originally chose a 10-year period, but then the article took some time to write. So we decided to start in January 2007 through July of 2019. And the goal was to identify well-powered RCTs that might reveal if these compounds, are efficacious for treating, psychiatric disorders. And we came across a total of 1,603 articles. And so we reviewed the abstracts of those articles. And then of those, we found that 161 of those articles were actually relevant, to the question we wanted to answer. And then we decided from that there were 14 well-designed clinical trials that investigated, LSD, psilocybin, ayahuasca, and MDMA for treating, psychiatric pathology.
We've mentioned a few drugs so far. How did you determine which ones to look at?
We really decided on doing this review on LSD, ayahuasca, MDMA, and psilocybin because they've been increasingly covered by the media for their therapeutic potential over the past 5 years. So we figured that there would probably be a lot of questions. So the goal was to review and provide clinicians and researchers with a summary of the data so that they could potentially answer questions to patients or, you know, decide, hey, you know, here's where the evidence is currently at, despite what I'm hearing in the media, which may not be providing all of the facts. And, you know, I can kind of, you know, make a decision on whether or not I want to pursue research in this area, or this is what I can tell patients.
Okay, well, in the spirit of presenting facts, let's get to the results of your work. What were some of your findings that stood out to you?
You know, I'm a little biased on this just because I spend my days treating addiction and PTSD. So I think perhaps my favorite study from the group was a MAP study. So that's the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. So what they did is they enrolled 26 personnel, so firefighters and police officers primarily, who met criteria for PTSD, and they enrolled them in two MDMA psychotherapy sessions coupled with, you know, integrative therapy. And what they did is they gave seven of these participants 30 milligrams of MDMA, seven of these participants 75 milligrams of MDMA, and 12 of these participants 125 milligrams of MDMA. And what they found is that a month after treatment, 86% of the participants who received, you know, 75 milligrams of MDMA were in complete remission of PTSD. They found that 58% of the participants that received 125 milligrams of MDMA were in complete remission of PTSD. And they found that 29% of the participants that received 30 milligrams of MDMA were in complete remission. And I think this is very interesting because, you know, it highlights that MDMA may be a breakthrough treatment for the treatment of PTSD, but it also shows that the dosing of the psychedelics may matter. In this case, the middle dose, the 75 milligrams, is the one that was the most efficacious. Now MAPS is doing a phase 3 clinical trial, so we'll see how that turns out. They may have the same findings. That was the part of the research that I thought was perhaps most surprising, just because it's relevant to the work I do every day. With that said, you know, I have to say that the psilocybin research is also, you know, surprising. The fact that, you know, so many patients, you know, have, you know, improvements in anxiety, you know, around diagnosis of cancer, and that's incredible. And also the fact that psilocybin can lead to the remission of major depressive disorder. There aren't as many of those studies right now, but now there are two phase 3 clinical trials happening. So we'll have answers soon. But there's a lot of promising data right now.
There's an interesting section of your review that compares the psychological effects and neurobiology of psychedelic compounds. Could you describe some of these relationships?
Yeah, sure. You know, we found it really interesting that many of these drugs had overlapping psychological effects, but very different pharmacologic mechanisms. So unlike, say, the SSRIs, which seem to act very similarly, these drugs acted very differently. So for example, you had drugs that were tryptamines, which would include LSD, which is a synthetic drug, and plant-derived drugs like psilocybin. So you compare that to a drug like MDMA, which is a phenylethylamine, and it's a very different structure and a very different mechanism of action. Yet both these drugs are associated with feelings of empathy and social connectedness. So really, understanding the pharmacology of these compounds may well help us understand the neurobiology of depression, PTSD, as well as some pretty interesting constructs such as mysticism and social connectedness.
Interesting. And Dr. McDonald, you had mentioned earlier that there is a desire out there to look at new treatments and maybe more effective treatments. And one of the treatments that you had mentioned was ketamine, and it's getting a lot of attention these days. And so could you explain how ketamine came to be used in clinical care, and then tell us what studies have shown about its safety and effectiveness?
Sure. Ketamine's not a classic psychedelic, but a dissociative anesthetic. It works through NMDA antagonism, and its therapeutic effect is through the glutamate system. So it provides a novel treatment. And that's what people have been finding, that patients who didn't respond to other antidepressants responded to ketamine. The other thing that's interesting about ketamine is that it not only has an effect in treatment-resistant depression, but it can have a marked effect in suicidal ideation, and that can occur after one or two treatments. So it's very different from the antidepressants, which can take weeks to months to work. The work group on biomarkers and novel treatments, the same work group that looked at the psychedelics in this paper, looked at the ketamine data in 2015. Jeff Newport was the first author, and they pointed out a number of concerns related to the potential for abuse and neurotoxicity, particularly with long-term use. And at the time of our 2015 review, there were no studies on the long-term use of IV ketamine. There are now some case reports talking about long-term use. These potential side effects are particularly important as ketamine patients can relapse quickly and require maintenance therapy to maintain their response. One of the issues to consider when prescribing IV ketamine is that it's an off-label use of this drug. The drug is Schedule III. It's used in anesthesia, but the use of it for depression is off-label. There's now an FDA-approved drug, esketamine, which is used by nasal insufflation, and it will be important to try and see if this drug works as well or works in a different population than IV ketamine. So trying to look at the ketamine over time may be very important, and this goes back to a drug that Colin brought up, psilocybin. So one of the studies that he described, the work with psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy, really offered an important alternative treatment. People after one or two sessions with psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy could be well for 6 months. That's very different than most of the medications that we have out there now. Even ECT has a 50% relapse rate within 6 months. So trying to understand how these drugs work and if they work longer term with just initial sessions is going to be an important part of the research that needs to be done.
And your review also discussed the psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. You note that the two most widely used paradigms here are psycholytic therapy and psychedelic therapy. Can you outline these therapies?
Yes. So psycholytic therapy evolved in Europe in the 1950s, really through the 1970s. And the father of it was a German psychiatrist by the name of Hans Karolina. And after he passed, or actually during his life, Stanislav Grof also became, you know, a pioneer of this treatment. And the idea is that the psychedelic acts as a catalyst for psychotherapy over several sessions. And what it does is it offers access to the unconscious, really with the goal of facilitating, you know, a discharge of emotionally charged psychic tension, or perhaps lowers the resistance. So an individual is able to talk about something that they may otherwise repress or in some instances suppress. So it really, the drug works in tandem with the therapy, and psycholytic therapy is kind of born out of psychoanalysis. This is very different, different from psychedelic therapy, which developed simultaneously in the United States. And the idea is that you give a very large dose of psychedelic to create a revelatory or transcendent experience in which the individual might have an epiphany and a religious awakening. And from this, they may acquire new perspective on their life or their situation, and suddenly things may appear different. And then the work to be done is, after that experience happens, is to kind of integrate it into daily life. So just to summarize, I would say that psycholytic therapy is about working in tandem with the psychedelic over several sessions, whereas the psychedelic therapy is more about a mystical experience, as the Johns Hopkins group has termed it, and about integrating that experience into life.
Your study is encouraging in its findings with regards to these drugs, but is there potential for these kind of drugs to be misused?
It's an excellent question. And the truth is that despite all of these drugs being classified as psychedelics, they're different. For instance, the hallucinogens, the classic hallucinogens, such as, you know, LSD, psilocybin, ayahuasca, are not associated with uncontrollable drug-seeking behavior. And, you know, animals cannot be trained to self-administer these drugs. This is different than MDMA, you know, MDMA is essentially a derivative of methamphetamine, and it's almost a hybrid of methamphetamine and mescaline. So it kind of has stimulant properties, but also has psychedelic properties. So in animal models, MDMA shows, you know, patterns of episodic use at irregular intervals. And that seems to show that there is maybe some potential for abuse. So far, the evidence suggests that it's less than amphetamine and methamphetamine, but I wouldn't necessarily categorize it in the same group with LSD, psilocybin, and ayahuasca. Of note, we highlight this in the paper. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University recently evaluated the abuse potential of psilocybin, and they thought that it would be appropriate for it to be a Schedule IV drug. So that's in the same class as benzodiazepines and hypnotics such as Ambien. So we need more research in this area. We don't really know right now if patients that have previous struggles with addiction, if they were given these substances, how they might respond over time. We need more data. But so far, they seem to be relatively safe with limited abuse liability when given in controlled settings.
But with all that, overall, what are the conclusions that researchers, clinicians, and other mental health professionals should take away from your review?
They should take away that the database is promising. There has been a lot of great research done over the past decade that has reintroduced psychedelics into psychiatry and psychology. And we need more research right now. So far, things are going well. We don't want to move too fast, and we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the 1960s when these drugs left the lab and entered the mainstream and became Schedule I drugs. The goal right now is to really identify, are they efficacious in treating depression, PTSD, anxiety around cancer, and substance use disorders? If they are, let's show that and roll them out slowly. And no one should be taking these drugs right now unless they're in one of these clinical trials, because we don't have enough information.
You mentioned a lot of great research that went into the findings that you report in your review. So going forward, what recommendations do you have for further research in this area?
Well, I think we already talked about the preclinical research to really understand the neurobiology of these compounds. And along with that, understand their mechanism. And in terms of understanding the mechanism, it might give us real understanding of the neurobiology of things such as empathy or constructs such as mysticism. The potential for these drugs is also very promising clinically. As Colin pointed out, not just for PTSD, substance abuse, but I'm a geriatric psychiatrist who deals with treatment-resistant depression, and that is a very promising area for drugs like psilocybin. But they're also using these drugs in end-of-life care. Colin talked a little bit about anxiety in cancer patients, but also helping people resolve issues they could never resolve during their life at their end of life. So there's a lot of promise for these drugs, and these are areas for which we really do not have treatments. So we made a recommendation in the paper that the National Institute of Health, maybe with the FDA and private funding agencies such as Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, and the Hepler Institute, could get together, conduct an international symposia on clinical trial methodology and psychedelic research, sort of guide the field as to where we should go. And there's some really interesting areas to look at. For instance, you could imagine it's very difficult to blind and use a placebo in these studies. It's very similar to the challenge we have with ketamine, trying to use a drug that causes dissociation versus a drug which causes sedation, for instance. There's a lack of data on dose response. As Colin pointed out, that could be a very important area for search. There's patient biases and expectancies when they come into the studies. Right now, clinical trials sometimes include people with prior hallucinogenic experiences. It's hard to sort through that and reading through the papers, but obviously that would be a very important area to look at carefully. And they're using highly selected patient populations for good reasons, but they're leaving out, if you want to generalize this to the general public and use it in clinical practice, they're leaving out people, for example, who may have a family history of schizophrenia or have had a previous experience with psychosis. So you can understand why someone would do that, but that also may limit the generalizability of these drugs. The other important area, I think, is there's a real opportunity to develop scales to help measure some of the treatment effects. For example, I was struck by a lot of the research that went into what were people's experiences on psychedelics. And one of the things that you heard over and over again is that they described their experience on psychedelics as one of the most meaningful experiences in their lives. Well, I don't know how to quantify that or measure that, but that certainly seems like something we would want to look at in terms of the patients and their response to the medication. And as Colin's already pointed out, there's really a need to develop sort of an accepted standard for some of the research tools, which would be things such as psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, to make sure study to study, it's being done in a very similar way. So when you look at, say, cognitive behavioral therapy research programs, they're trying to do from one center to the next essentially the same therapy. It would be important that we start to standardize some of these important research tools. And then I think finally, this idea of understanding the potential for abuse. I think if we understood that, if that was clear, it would go a long way towards helping advance the research agenda. And I think that's why you want to include people like the FDA in terms of the trial designs to get an idea of what types of measures need to be taken, including National Institute of Drug Abuse, to look at what sorts of measures need to be done to look at abuse potential.
Well, this has all been very fascinating and it's very encouraging. Dr. Colin Reef and Dr. William McDonald, co-authors of a review article in our May issue on the use of psychedelics and psychedelic compounds in mental health treatment. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes this episode of AJP Audio. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. Please also visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. to check out trending articles, find CME courses, and watch videos highlighting some of our other articles. APA Publishing has other podcasts you can listen to. Psychiatry Unbound is the books podcast from APA Publishing. It's hosted by Dr. Laura Roberts, editor-in-chief of APA Books. Also check out From Pages to Practice, which reviews the latest research published in the journal Psychiatric Services. It's hosted by Dr. Lisa Dixon, editor-in-chief of the journal, along with Dr. Josh Berezin. You can subscribe to these podcasts on Apple, Google, Spotify, or on any of the popular platforms.
Next month in AJP Audio, we'll talk with Dr. Catherine McDuffie of the University of Washington about her research on sleep onset problems and subcortical development in infants later diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. We hope you'll join us too. Thank you for listening.